This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Israel shouldn't launch a major attack into Rafah without accounting for and protecting the civilians that are in that battle space.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Welcome aboard. Rob Breckenridge with you on a busy Thursday afternoon. That was the voice of U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. And clearly the Biden administration is at odds with Israel's government over what should happen next in Gaza, specifically around Rafah. So the U.S. president is now threatening to pause military aid to Israel if they go ahead with a full-blown assault on Rafah. Now, Israel's prime minister says they are still prepared to do so and will be prepared to act alone if necessary. So it's a real pivotal moment, I think, right now for this conflict. Now, Hamas, of course, is, I would assume, hoping that Israel doesn't move forward, that they are, from their perspective, trying to preserve some kind of hold on Gaza and trying to prevent a final defeat that the Israeli military is looking to inflict. So I think there is the concern here that this could give Hamas a bit of a breather, and this could allow Hamas to regroup and maybe reassert control over more of Gaza, make up for some of those losses it has suffered. And where does that leave us then? So I do think the Biden administration needs to think long and hard about how they see this conflict ending and how they view the question of Hamas's defeat. And what's going to convince Israel then that they need to stop their offensive, that they need to take a step back and even withdraw from Gaza altogether? I don't think Israel's prepared to accept a return to the status quo where Hamas is in charge and Hamas represents a threat. So joining us to talk more about where this whole situation might go from here, very pleased to welcome the program this afternoon, Dr. Casey Babb, senior fellow at the McDonnell Laurier Institute, also with the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University and the Institute for National Security Studies. Dr. Babb, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First of all, then, so what do you make of this moment we are at here with Israel poised to make a final push into Rafah, but encountering some resistance from the White House?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, it's of course, a very unfortunate, very difficult situation that Israel finds itself in. But then on the other hand, it is also not necessarily a new situation that Jerusalem finds itself in. You know, Israel has been sort of on its own many times before and has handled its business alone and in isolation many times before. And, you know, I think Benjamin Netanyahu and the security apparatus in Israel and the IDF, they're ready to do this again on their own if they have to.
So what is the situation right now in Gaza? Is there an Israeli victory that's imminent here, given how the conflict has maybe slowed in recent days or weeks? Has Hamas been able to recoup any of its losses?
That's a great question. I mean, over the last several months, and a lot of people are seem to be unaware of this, over the last several months, Hamas has regained control over much of the Gaza Strip, precisely for the reason that you've been talking about, and that is that Israel has essentially taken its foot off the gas because of primarily international pressure. So much of that pressure is creating a very challenging dynamic for Israel and the IDF. It's getting soldiers killed, it's getting hostages killed, and it's emboldening Hamas. So Hamas is actually in a very good situation right now, despite the looming offensive in Rafah.
Right. So what does it mean then in terms of some kind of possible resolution to this? Right. There's been talk that maybe things are close or getting closer to a ceasefire. But, you know, it seems pretty clear that a ceasefire that allows Hamas to retain power control in Gaza is not going to be acceptable to Israel, understandably so, I think. But so what does a possible end look like at this point?
Yeah, I mean, despite the barbarism that Hamas has inflicted on countless individuals, and despite their heinous crimes, their leadership is quite tactical, quite strategic. And they've been hiding and biding for months, and it's working in their favor. So, you know, I don't see there being any need for them to reach a ceasefire in the foreseeable future. I mean, they've had ample opportunities over the last 7 months to come to an agreement, and they haven't done that. And now we're at a point where they don't even have, and this is according to Hamas, enough hostages who are alive to meet some of these initial demands from Israel. In fact, now they appear to be, according to individuals I'm talking with in Israel, looking to barter actual with the bodies of some of the hostages, which is just absolutely appalling. So, look, there's no pressure on Hamas to hurry things along here. The last 7 months, things have been going okay for them.
Right, and anything that allows them to buy time, to regroup, that works to their advantage. So they've got a vested interest in delaying things, stalling things, making it appear as though there's some movement on a ceasefire. All of these delays, do you think that plays into their hands?
Absolutely. I mean, you're spot on. They want chaos in the region. They want death and destruction. They do not want a two-state solution. They want to retain control of Gaza, and they want to continue to exert control over Palestinians in Gaza and potentially the West Bank. And so these sorts of strategies, these this strategy of hiding and biding, and sort of, you know, a colleague of mine used to talk about these things in terms of ragging the puck. You know, that's what they're doing. They're hunkering down, and they're waiting things out. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people around the world who sympathize with Hamas, who sympathize with these terrorists, and it's working in their favor.
So what do you think Israel's objectives still are at this point? What does a ceasefire actually look like that Israel could be comfortable with?
That's a great question. Again, so what Israel has to do here, what is at the heart of the matter for Jerusalem, they're going to need all the hostages that are alive back, and they're going to need all of the bodies of any hostages in Gaza. That goes without saying. That's first matter. That's a top of the mind priority for Israel, and it always has been. And you know, unlike Hamas, who embraces death and destruction, Jews in Israel, they embrace life and the citizens of Israel, historically, as you know, they've done many things and gone to great lengths to secure the release of hostages. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, they need to get the hostages back. Second, they have to decapitate the leadership of Hamas. And three, they need to come up with a plan, probably with the international community, but maybe not, to control Gaza for the foreseeable future. You cannot leave Gaza in the hands of these terrorists, and you cannot put yourself in a situation where you're going to have another October 7th.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, certainly I think you look at public opinion in Canada, the U.S., still, I think, really supportive of Israel. I mean, I guess maybe maybe it's true for the Trudeau government, but the Biden administration as well. There's, I think, a real division within the Democratic Party. I think Biden's being pulled in different directions here, seeing where there's public support for Israel on the one hand, but these campus protests and elements in his own party wanting him to exert some pressure over Israel. How do you see all of these political dynamics in the U.S. and in North America and the West affecting the situation?
I mean, it's putting a great deal of pressure on Israel, and it's really, really complicating things. You know, Israel is the only country ever that's not allowed to win a war on its own terms for its own people. And that's because of people like President Biden and Prime Minister Trudeau. They would rather survive politically than do the right thing. And they haven't been doing the right thing. They've been trying to have their cake and eat it too. They've been trying to appease people who are horrified in their countries about what's been going on, while also ensuring that they pander to their constituents, to the Arab community and to the left. And that's what we're seeing right now. And it's getting people killed in Israel, but it's also creating a very, very hostile environment for Jews in the West.
Yeah. Absolutely, which is really disturbing to see. We'll see where things go from here. In the meantime, much more at McDonaldLaurier.ca. Casey, thanks so much for the insight. Appreciate you making some time for us here today.
All right, sir. Thank you.
All the best. That is Dr. Casey Babb, as mentioned, senior fellow of the McDonaldLaurier Institute, also with the Glaser Center, the Institute for National Security Studies, and the Norman Patterson School in International Affairs, Carleton University. So some thoughts on where things stand here today with Israel feeling that it needs to make some decisive moves here to basically decapitate Hamas in Gaza, but increasing pressure from the U.S. to hold off on doing so. The conversation in this hour off the top about the future of Canada Post. What needs to change? It doesn't feel like we can just stick with the status quo. In fact, the world has changed. And maybe part of the problem is that Canada Post hasn't adjusted to that. But we found out this week that they are increasing the price of stamps, which isn't really the big story. The big story is why. Canada Post reported a $748 million annual loss for 2023. That comes off losses in the previous couple of years and warnings that more big losses lie ahead. So does that mean reducing Canada Post, cutting back on what it does, changing what it does, privatizing it, doing away with it altogether? What needs to change? Because, like I say, this doesn't feel at all sustainable. Well, somebody who has done extensive research into Canada Post and its operations and its challenges is on the line with us here this afternoon. Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor of Management, the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. Professor Lee, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Rob.
First of all, these losses, do they come as a surprise to you at all?
No, I've been predicting them for 15 years or more in my various studies. I did my PhD thesis on Canada Post. It was 850 pages, by the way. I read every annual report from 1760, which was the British Post Office in British North America, up into 1981 when my thesis ended. And then I did the follow-up study with the McDonaldLaurier Institute think tank from 1981 to then 2015. And I'm doing another study now, reading right up to the annual report that was released yesterday. The numbers are empirical. They're in the audited. I don't do interviews with people at post office or anybody. I just look at data, hard data, audited data. And these are from the audited annual reports. Mm-hmm. In 2006 was the high water mark for letter mail in Canada, 7 billion pieces. So I'm not playing with inflation and dollars and price of stamps. No. Let's not do that. 7 billion pieces. That means people used the post office 7 billion times. Fast forward from then until now, every year, it's been declining by 8 to 10% a year. Last year, it was less than 2 billion pieces. So we, the people, businesses, small, medium, large, and all of us in Canada are using the post office less and less and less and less year by year by year. I predict within 5 to 7 years, there will be nothing left but a tiny little tale of maybe a couple of 100,000 letters written by overwhelmingly elderly people. And I'm not young, by the way. I'm over 65, so nobody can accuse me of being ageist.
Right.
And so the core business, which is by far the most profitable, Deloitte, in its testimony to the Blue Ribbon panel that Trudeau appointed in 2016 or 17, said the profit margin of letters was about 50%. Phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Except that they're all disappearing and they're going to be gone in another 5 or 6 or 7 years. So that leaves them with there's two other core products, junk mail or so-called ad mail, which is also in steep decline because it's getting digitized also, electronic flyers. And then finally, parcels. Parcels should be the future of Canada Post. Why? Because Stats Canada is showing what we all know. E-commerce is skyrocketing. It's growing like crazy. And they need partners to deliver all of those things that we order online. So it really took off, went up during the pandemic. So one would think that Canada Post should have seen their parcels delivered skyrocket. Right. Because now you got one market that's actually growing like crazy. Their market share fell by 50%. This is from the audited annual report of 2 days ago. So these are what the numbers are saying of Canada Post and their auditors. They have three product lines, and they're going negative in all three. And if they don't reinvent themselves really, really quickly, and I don't mean in 10 or 15 or 20 years, how about in the next 12 to 24 months, mm-hmm. then they are going to disappear. And for those who say you don't understand, Ian, we still use the post office, I pose a question to everybody listening. Will the taxpayers of Canada support paying a $5 billion or more dollars a year for a Potemkin post office where we have 50,000 letter carriers all across Canada march up and down every street in Canada to the 16.5 million addresses, residential and business, pretending to deliver mail that we, the people, and the businesses of Canada are not sending? That is the issue.
Yeah.
I don't consult to these people. I've been studying this data. It's inexorable. And for those who say, you don't understand, there's lots of people still using the post office, let me be really blunt. I've been teaching for 37 years. My students, all students, young people are the most digitized people in human history. And when I bring up the subject of the post office, they just laugh. They think it's hilarious. They call it, that's my grandmother's technology. That's analog. That's even before the boomers, which is a real insult, by the way. Okay, young people aren't going to send letters. Anyone who thinks that, oh, no, we're going to go back to the good old days. We're all going to start writing letters again. No, we use social media. We use TikTok. We use fax. We use text. We use email. We use every form of digital communication. And we're not writing letters, and it's not coming back. And businesses are digitizing small, medium, and large. And they're doing it day by day, week by week. And so that's why the postal business, which has been their core, from the very beginning when the British set it up in 1760-61, set up the post office in British North America, as it was then called, right down to today, the core has been letters. And as I said, they're vanishing. And they're unfortunately not competitive in parcels. Can I just throw up one more quick figure to you, Rob, so everybody really understands the nature of the problem? This data is not public because I can't get it. They won't disclose it. I'm talking about the cost per truck in this country, whether you're private or public. So I went to a couple of large couriers, and they said, only will we tell you the data off the record, and don't you ever quote us. I said, no, I won't, but I'll speak about it generically. Because I'm a former banker, I said, look, somebody's got this data. What's the cost per truck, including the driver and the gasoline, the fuel? Because there's somebody crunching these numbers in accounting. He said, oh, we've got those numbers. We have a very good sense. Canada Post, we estimate, runs $60 to $65 per hour, per truck, including the driver and the fuel, across Canada. I said, okay, what about the privates, the FedExes, and the DHLs, and so forth? Oh, $40 to $45 per hour, per truck, including the driver and the fuel. I said, yes, but I'm getting e-commerce to my door on a Friday night at 11 o'clock at night, and I see a small little car pull away, or 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock. And I said, these are the Intel comms. They're gig drivers. They own their own car. I said, how much is that running? Well, you must have a number. He said, yeah, $25 an hour. So Canada Post is running $65, and people can quibble and say, no, it's $62. Look, Canada Post is way up at the high end, somewhere in the 60s range per truck, including driver and fuel, and you've got competitors who are as low as in the mid-20s.
That's crazy.
Now, I understand arithmetic. And I understand that $20 or $25 an hour per truck, driver, and fuel is vastly, vastly cheaper than $60 to $65. And people can quibble again over, no, it's $57, it's not $61. They're somewhere between double and triple over the competitors. And that's why the numbers are declining and collapsing for Canada Post. They've got to reinvent themselves, get out of this industry, out of letters. That means closing. Now I'm going to really upset your listeners. They got to close down all of their post offices. People aren't going into the post offices because they're not buying stamps, because they're not sending anything in the post office. It's costing over $1.5 billion a year to keep up these Potemkin post offices for people that are not using it. And they're delivering home delivery to 25% of Canadians living in the most privileged, wealthy neighborhoods in Canada, including the Glebe in Ottawa. Full disclosure, I live there. I get home delivery. I should not. Mm-hmm. Including Rockcliffe, where the Prime Minister and the Governor General and all the most expensive housing neighborhoods in Canada are getting home delivery. And Deloitte estimated that costs over $500 million a year. They got to get rid of that. And then they got to focus like a laser beam on parcels, but they're not even remotely close. They got to become much more flexible, much more dynamic, and they've got to go to dynamic routing, and they have to, right now in the collective agreement, they get paid double time if they work on the weekends, when the courier companies do a lot of business. And so they're not only uncompetitive now, but if they work on the weekends, they're even less competitive. So there's a major restructuring going on that will be needed. And if they don't, they will go the way of Blockbuster Video. When streaming came along, and it absolutely killed and destroyed video stores, because why would you go to a video store to rent a video when you can watch the movie at home streaming it on Bell Fiber Rogers?
Yeah.
And that's the dilemma that they're in. And so these stories, and I hear them and I just laugh, and they say, well, maybe they should start delivering passports, or maybe, you know, they should start offering applications to do get a loan at the bank. That's not going to save them.
No.
Their whole model, their whole Canada Post is based on the traditional business model of letter mail, which is you deliver, you go to all 16.5 million addresses, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year. And the parcel model is based on the opposite model, where you only take the parcel to the person when they have a parcel to when you have a parcel to deliver to them. You do not go out 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year to 16.5 million addresses. That's going to be a much, much smaller post office. How big? I don't know. 5,000 employees, 10,000 employees, instead of 60,000 employees. But it's a very different model, and the post office and the government of Canada are still in deep denial of these numbers and these trends.
Well, that's what it feels like. And I wanted to ask that because if we look then at this 16-year, 17-year window, or we look 2006 to today when so many of these trends really emerged, what, if anything, has Canada Post done to change or adjust to these new realities? Or has it been business as usual?
I've gone through the annual report line by line of every annual report from 16 till now, 2006, excuse me, until now, and they haven't. There's been lip service. Under the former CEO, he understood the gravity. He was trying to rebuild, reinvent the post office as the essential partner of e-commerce. Full disclosure, I met him twice. Not to discuss consulting, I have not ever consulted the Canada Post. And we had like minds. He'd seen me in the media talking about this, and I said, you know, you guys are doomed. I said this back in 2015 when I was writing my MLI report. I said, you're doomed unless you reinvent yourself as a parcel post company, partnered with the Amazons. He said, yes, I know. That's exactly where we have to go. The new government was elected, and they completely rejected his vision. And he was asked to leave or fired, I'm not sure which, but he was forced out. I was invited to testify before the Blue Ribbon Panel of 2016 or 17, appointed by Mr. Trudeau, to investigate the future. And I said, essentially, right now what I'm saying to you, I said to the Blue Ribbon Panel. And they completely rejected it and said, no, we need to, you know, we got to find new sources of demand. And CUPW was arguing this very strongly as well. We're going to get banking in the post offices and bring back the Postal Savings Bank and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it was all spin, because that's not their business. They're not banks. They can't compete with banks. And their business is delivering something that is, well, it served them well from literally 1761 until now. It's going by this. It's going the same way as home delivery of milk. It's going the same way as video rental stores. We, millions and millions of us, are not using the post office, and the data is crystal clear, no matter how much people deny it. And that's just a reality. So if they're going to survive, they're going to have to reinvent as a parcel company, a competitor, but it's going to be really hard because they're so uncompetitive right now, and they're so inflexible in their corporate structure.
And even if you have a CEO that recognizes the need to do that, there is that political reality. You know, the Liberals, as you say, they didn't want to make those changes. They didn't want to take away the daily home delivery for so many Canadians. So there are political realities that seem to be a barrier to the needed reform.
I completely agree. I mean, there's many members of Parliament, probably in all three parties, all four parties, that would deny what I'm saying. But the data is, you can't deny the pieces of mail being delivered. And something else that people may not realize, they have an enormous unfunded liability in their pension plan because it was then Prime Minister Harper, and then it continued by Prime Minister Trudeau. So you can see I'm being nonpartisan here. They suspended their commitment to the pension plan, and their pension plan now has an unfunded liability of over $6 billion. So we the taxpayers of Canada are facing an enormous, I mean, it's a ticking delayed time bomb, and because the deficit is going to get worse year by year as the number of letters decline. That's what the 50% profit margin per letter decline, continue to steadily decline 8, 10% or even faster in the years ahead. In very near future, we'll be waking up to, and I mean in 3 or 4 years, a post office running deficits of $3 billion, $4 billion, and then we will have some very hard questions. Are we, the people of Canada, the taxpayers of Canada, willing to pay that kind of money to support a Potemkin post office? And it will be a Potemkin post office. That is to say, 50,000 people marching up and down the streets with nothing to deliver. And it's not their fault. I'm not trying to say they're junking the mail. There's no mail to deliver because we are not using it. It's down to 2 billion pieces. What happens? It's going to be down to a billion pieces in a couple of years. And then it's going to get down to 500,000 pieces. So it's steadily declining, especially as the older generation that are the most intensive users of the post office die off. I'm being blunt, but I have to speak truth to power. You know, I'm older. You know, when we get older, one day we die. And we're not used. Young people don't use the post office, period. Not at all, period. They are digital. Yeah. And this is the digitization of everything. And for those who really want to get sort of analytical on this, the most brilliant book ever written on this was written by Professor Nicholas Negroponte at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1995. He wrote the book Being Digital, and he explained over the next 3 decades, everything that is informational will be digitized. Media, broadcasting, TV, radio, magazines, newspapers, banking, universities, education, and he said it's going to turn everything upside down. Jeff Bezos was the first person who really understood what he was saying, and he went and founded Amazon.com. So this digitization of everything is what's driving it. It's not partisan. It's the conversion of from the analog world that I grew up in and that many older people grew up in into the purely digital world that we are living in. And it's going to continue inexorably. It's not going to go away, and we're not going back to the analog world.
All right. We're going to have to confront this sooner or later. We'll leave it there for now. I always appreciate the insight, Dr. Lee. Thanks so much for making some time for us here this afternoon.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
There you go. That's Ian Lee, Associate Professor of Management, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University. As he says, has done extensive research on Canada Post and the challenges it faces. And right now, they are considerable. So something's got to give. And welcome back. So last week we had the first report from the public inquiry into foreign interference released by Justice Marie-Jose Hogue. More work to be done. But the inquiry has been illuminating in a lot of ways and really helping us understand that, yes, foreign interference did occur and the extent to which it occurred, and largely, of course, the work of China's government. But what's emerged along the way, both in the inquiry and the stories that led up to the inquiry, are the revelations about not just the work that intelligence agencies are doing in trying to stay on top of these interference efforts, but also the warnings the government received. Now, it's hoped that in the next phase of this inquiry, we're going to get a better understanding of how all of these warnings were handled and how governments responded to the information that was being presented to them. And that's how it works. We have these agencies that exist to safeguard the security of Canada. And they present information to government. Government decides how best to act. But I think part of the concern here is that governments didn't act. That information was presented and it fell on deaf ears. Or government just decided that there wasn't enough to act on. Or maybe they had their own self-interest in not acting. So that's been one of the troubling aspects to this whole story, is that it's reassuring that we have intelligence agencies that are aware of this problem, that are targeting this problem. But if those warnings aren't being acted on, then it's all for naught, perhaps. So for those who worked in the intelligence community, I would imagine some frustration, even maybe a feeling of disrespect when it comes to the work they do. Somebody who has seen it all from the inside is Andrew Kirsch, a former intelligence officer with CSIS, author of I Was Never Here, My True Canadian Spy Story of Coffey's Code Names and Covert Operations in the Age of Terror. There's a really interesting piece on the foreign interference issue up today at thehub.ca. Andrew, so good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
As I say, you got a unique perspective on all of this, given the work you've done within CSIS. So as you've watched this whole story unfold and things come to light at the inquiry, what have you made of it all? Just your initial impressions, first of all.
Well, I do have some inside perspective with regards to my work at CSIS, obviously. But for me, it's very interesting to see the political side. You know, there's this unique relationship between our security service, where we collect analyze and advise government on threats to the security of Canada, and then the government decides what to do about it. And so I was an intelligence officer. I was out knocking on doors, collecting information and sending that information, which gets processed into intelligence up the chain. And then at other stage, and people at different levels than me were kind of providing that, those intelligence briefs, those memos to the decision makers. And so this has really provided an inside look to many folks like myself who were kind of on one end of that spectrum as to how it was, how that information was received, how the intelligence service is perceived, and you know what happened with that threat that was being warned about. And that's kind of what I wrote about is from my perspective as an intelligence officer to say, you know, we're out there collecting and foreign interference is a core part of CSIS's mandate and a disappointment with what happened on the other end of that chain.
Yeah, which we can talk about. But I'm curious, too. I mean, we've learned, I think, with all of this, how sophisticated some of these efforts are. And so this is difficult work, but the fact that it seems as though CSIS was on top of this, was aware of this, was issuing warnings about this, do you think that vindicates the work they do?
Well, I'm biased. I work there. I'm proud of the fact that I was an intelligence officer with CSIS. I believe in the work the organization does and that Canada faces very real threats. And unfortunately, a lot of that work happens in the shadows that people will never know about. I had to work almost 10 years and couldn't tell most people where I worked, what I did, who I was meeting with. And that's just a part of the job. But what you're doing is passing information up that we think is important, that we think contributes to the security of Canada. And I think what this validates is that information exists, that CSIS was on top of the threat. It was providing this information to decision makers, and it wasn't necessarily a lack of awareness or a blind spot this was happening, but you know, maybe we weren't actioning or doing proper mitigation with the threat that we were facing.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, there's a limit to what CSIS can do. I mean, the RCMP can conduct investigations and make arrests, but it's not as though we have, you know, spies that, okay, we've detected this Chinese operation, get in there and go stop it or intervene. Like, basically, it's an intelligence-gathering approach, isn't it?
That's right. The CSIS advises and government decides. And so some of the things that we were seeing in the inquiry was, well, you know, like, they didn't give us kind of recommendations, or that's not really CSIS's role. We provide intelligence, and I'm very sensitive to the fact that intelligence isn't always a complete picture, right? It's not evidence. What it is kind of an understanding, a processing of information, provide some sentinel intelligence, some insight into risks, and then we need to figure out, okay, what are the appropriate mitigation strategies to deal with that risk and the threats that we face. So CSIS, yes, it's not always evidence. There's not always a smoking gun. We say, look, there's a smoking gun, and then something would have gone off already. Obviously, we're trying to get ahead of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the government has a difficult decision, absolutely, on what to do with it. Where you may not always have a complete picture, but you have information that we felt that CSIS felt was worth bringing to light. And if we remember why this all came up and why we had public inquiry, it's because of leaks. And I think the leaks were a demonstration that there was a frustration from an individual. Leaks are bad. Leaks are wrong. We cannot rely on leaks to have policy discussions. But that there was obviously a frustration with somebody who had a unique insight into the threat that the public needed to know, that they felt that maybe the decisions that decision makers were making weren't appropriate. And they took this kind of very dramatic step to leak these reports in public so that we'd be having this conversation. And I think that's another thing that it's not very healthy for our intelligence service, the relationship with politicians, and as I said, how we make policy. We can't do that through leaks.
Yeah, what does that do for morale? Right, because as you write in your piece, it was something you heard from management often that the work you're doing is appreciated, and the prime minister has, as much as he's cast doubt on the intelligence he says he was receiving, he's tried to say that as well. We really appreciate the work these agencies are doing, but it's got to be tough on morale, I would think.
Yeah, it's difficult when you make sacrifices, and every job has its challenges. I would say CSIS's challenges are unique. As I said, you have to lie to many people of what you're doing. You don't get a lot of public recognition can't even come home and say, you know, I'm really proud I got to do X, Y, and Z today, the people who are closest to you. So you rely on that kind of validation that this is important, the work we do is important, and that the people who know appreciate it, and that that information is getting to the right folks who are able to take that and take steps to keep Canadians safe. I say in the piece, you know, I ran away and joined the circus and this idea of becoming an intelligence officer because I wanted to serve, and I felt that's the way that I could, you know, serve and protect our country. Mm-hmm. And it's disheartening to think that the work that I was doing and some other folks were doing were, you know, in some way dismissed. Just I don't read all the reports, and I that's not how it was presented to me. And, you know, we take information from CSIS with a huge grain of salt, and it's our job to question it. And there is that relationship. The government should have a healthy dialogue to say, well, how corroborated is this information and how reliable is it, and have that exchange. But it came across as very dismissive, and that was tough to hear. And I'm sure that I've been out for a few years now, and I'm sure it's difficult for my colleagues here, especially the ones who were working on these files for many, many years.
What are the longer-term implications? Because this isn't just about, okay, this happened in the past, what was done or not done. It's also about, you know, dealing with these threats moving forward. And that disconnect then between government and these agencies, or making those who work on the front lines wonder what the point of it all is, does it potentially erode our national security?
One of the things that I spoke about in the piece was this idea that when I signed up in 2006, this is post 9/11. We had the London bombings, July 7, 2005, mm-hmm. and there was this very tangible, real, you know, bombs going off in capitals, right? And we were, you know, one of my jobs as a collector was to go knock on doors and say, "I'm here from CSIS, and I'm here. I'm trying to fight terrorism." And it was a very clear threat that people kind of understood, and they felt enough for me to run away and do this, and for people to help me and give me information to say, "We're worried about this. We see it happening. We don't want it to happen here." And one of the things that I talk about in the piece is that the threats are becoming more nuanced. Where we had the Toronto 18, which was a plot to, you know, blow up Parliament or behead the Prime Minister, now we're seeing, okay, terrorism is hacking into water treatment plants and changing chemical levels, and foreign interference is doing state-sponsored misinformation campaigns during elections. It's more nuanced, it's more gray, it's often unattributable, and people don't feel it in the same way. You know, it's reported that, look at Nortel kind of being hacked, and we have IP theft. It's often unattributable, often people don't kind of know what they can do to protect against it. It's very gray, and often the solutions are not so straightforward. So when we're dealing with the threats being tougher to track, and maybe a government that, because there's not as much pressure to deal with these threats, that I believe that's a real threat to our national security. That becomes a challenge, right? We're only as strong as the people who are getting up every day to do this work, and the folks who are willing to action it and take steps to act on that advice. And it seems somewhere along the way, we've lost a bit of will to act, and maybe we're not empowering those agencies to in the same way when they need it more than ever.
There is, you know, the question, though. I mean, if it matters to Canadians, then I think eventually maybe it matters to government. After all, we elect governments. And I do wonder if that's the silver lining of this whole process, as much as, you know, it is shown that there were perhaps mistakes in the past, that absent this public inquiry, we probably wouldn't know as much about it. And now that Canadians are becoming aware of it, if they demand better, maybe we'll get better. Is that the possible silver lining as you see it?
I hope so. You know, Canada is, for whatever safety and security we enjoy in Canada, and we do, you know, it is not an accident, and it's not guaranteed to continue. It's because, on some level, the security apparatus that we have in place is working, you know, to whatever degree, and that needs to be recalibrated from time to time. It was a post 9/11, and we had a surge, and CSIS ramped up, and, you know, we put a lot of money and resources into this threat that we were facing, and then it kind of erodes, and the further away we go, I think, you know, people are less inclined to invest in it, to be as thoughtful about it. And so, you know, I think that we really need public to be aware of the threats and not to scare folks, but to say, yeah, these things are important, that just because something isn't happening, you know, it's not evidence that it's not there, that it's not a challenge, but that those folks who are mandated to protect us are doing their job and they should be supported. So that is a challenge with national security, where we don't want to rely on something bad happening for us to be reactive. Mm-hmm. And we hope that we can keep a certain level of vigilance and not get too complacent. And I think where this episode has shown that, you know, we maybe we're allowed to get complacent, and now because this information is being public, that hopefully we can be more vigilant, that we can have people understand this threat and be willing to take the kind of steps that we need to take, things like foreign agent registry, you know, other maybe legislative steps to tackle it, which is ultimately that we have these organizations, we have these agencies, we have these apparatus. They're there for a reason. They do good work, important work, and we should support them.
Absolutely. Well, your piece is mentioned. It's up at thehub.ca. Andrew, really appreciate the insight on all this. Thanks so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
All the best. It's Andrew Kirsch, former intelligence officer at CSIS, currently CEO of Kirsch Group, a security risk consulting firm, author of the book, I Was Never Here, My True Canadian Spy Story of Coffees, Codenames, and Covert Operations, and an article posted at thehub.ca. And how important it is for governments, for prime ministers to take advice from security agencies seriously. And unfortunately, in this case, it appears as though that did not happen. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.